netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today, Mike Seymour is going to speak with Robert Newman, stereo supervisor at Disney Animation, about some of the technical issues having to do with stereo, working in 3D, solving problems, the kind of things people face every day in creating a quality stereo product. I'm recording this the day after the Visual Effects Society VES Awards last night at the Beverly Hilton. It was quite a nice night. Great to see everybody every year at this event. It's a quality event, and it'll be broadcast. We've got an article up on FX Guide. It's going to be shown on TV, and the times are listed in the article over at FX Guide, along with a bunch of photographs we took from the event, and hope you'll check that out and congratulate all the people that won awards last night. Certainly an interesting year with different makeup of winners from what you would have expected if you looked at the field of movies coming up at the beginning of the year. Well, let's jump now with Mike Seymour talking to Robert Newman about stereo.
So, Robert, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So I was wondering if we could discuss some of the tools at the disposal of the team with regards to stereo. But before we do that, if we could just do a little bit of your background, because I think people are really interested to know where you're from and how you sort of got to where you've got, because I really do honestly believe that Disney right now is at the cutting edge of stereo. But, I mean, how did you get to be where you were? What was the path?
Well, it's kind of a convoluted thing. I mean, going way back, I actually come from a technical background. I have a graduate degree in electrical engineering, and I had actually worked for a while as an engineer and a program manager for the Department of Defense.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was kind of my first career, but I'd always been a film buff, and I'd also always had artistic ability and inclinations, and at some point I noticed that the computer graphics were it was actually when I was teaching as an adjunct, while I was working on my master's degree in engineering, and I was called upon to see if I could teach a class in computer graphics, and so, I said sure, let me brush up on that a little bit, I dug in, and at the time, this was early 90s, and using Alias Wavefront, Wavefront Composer, and SGI based CG stuff. And well, any case, so they were interested in using that for like architectural visualizations, and so I started digging into that a bit, and it's I became quite adept at the camera work, doing architectural fly-throughs of buildings and kind of large scale road projects and housing projects, and what really interested me was the kind of more creative uses of it, and so at that point I started I hooked up with some production companies and started doing some effects for commercials and that type of work, music videos, and I guess what the hallmark of my work, what stood out, was the my sense of camera, the cinematography, and at some point I had put together a nice reel, and I was at SIGGRAPH, presented it to Disney, and at the time they were gearing up to do the movie Dinosaur, which was kind of their first CG production.
And if we think back to Dinosaur, that was really an interesting film. I remember them doing a LiDAR scan, one of the first, of the side of a mountain for one of the scenes. And there was like a lot of really hardcore technology in that film.
Oh, yeah, it was amazing. I mean, we from a cinematography standpoint, I mean, there was a lot of cutting-edge stuff. They developed a lot of kind of unique, you know, because it was the blend of, like, live action with the animated characters. Mm. And what was interesting was, you know, I was involved in doing what we call 3D workbook, which was kind of, you know, I guess today it would be called pre-viz. And what we were doing was designing the cinematography for the film, you know, on the computer, in CG, but with, you know, knowing that a lot of the most of the backgrounds were going to be filmed on live action plates.
Which meant you must have had a detailed understanding of real lensing, because otherwise you'd have produced
exactly.
Shots that are impossible to get.
Exactly. So we had to, right, we had to, you know, make sure that we had, you know, that we're using the same, you know, the same prime lenses that were available to, you know, to the camera crews. And also we had to mock up the rigs, and they had some pretty interesting rigs. They, you know, besides the, you know, the normal things you find in live action, they had built like, the thing they called the Dino Cam, which was, it was this, this wire cam. It was a huge, huge wire-mounted, you know, camera rig that could do these flying camera shots. And then they had to get all kinds of, you know, crazy stuff, because they were filming out. God, they scoured, I mean, all the corners of the planet to scout out locations for this. And you know, they had these camera rigs. They built these. They called them ladder pods. It was huge tripods built out of extension ladders. So they could get, you know, all kinds of crazy angles. So, which was good, because that kind of, you know, helped us not be, you know, because in CG you're kind of unlimited as to where you can put the camera.
Absolutely. And grounding that in reality was terrific.
Exactly. But but fortunately, at least, you know, with all of the wide ranging type of camera rigs that they built for this, for that production, you know, we're able to kind of stretch those boundaries a little bit, at least. Which was kind of nice, kind of freed us up a little bit on the CG side. But anyway, so you know, Dinosaur, you know, I kind of got it was my first feature production that I worked on.
Now, and we're going to talk a lot about some Disney films in a second, obviously most recently things like Tangled, but I would be remiss if I didn't indulge my children and ask you about Spirit, because I have two girls, and I must have seen that film about 100 times.
Spirit, that was
kind of like a lost film, in the sense that I don't think it ever really got the sort of acclaim that it deserved, but it was like Matt Damon was doing one of the voices, and that was a good film. But that wasn't a Disney film.
No, that was actually, so, you know, after Dinosaur wrapped up, I was lured away at DreamWorks, where they were gearing up to do Spirit, which you just mentioned. And interesting thing about Spirit was, well, up until that point, DreamWorks hadn't been doing much with CG. You know, they had done Prince of Egypt, which was traditionally animated. And they were, at the time I was there, you know, starting up on Spirit, they were still under production for Road to El Dorado, which was also traditionally animated. And both of those did not really extensively use CG for layout purposes. It was all traditional hand-drawn layout. And with Spirit, they wanted to get something more cinematic. And in order to do that, you have to, you know, it necessitates being able to free up the camera a little bit, and not, you know, move away from just straight multi-plane 2D camera work. And you know, since we had done some really pioneering work on Dinosaur in terms of CG layout and pre-viz, I was kind of lured away to DreamWorks to kind of kickstart that process over there, where they were, you know, beginning to do the layout work on Spirit. And, you know, what I helped them establish over there was a pipeline that used basically, the goal was, ideally we would have done every shot as a CG layout, but in terms of the schedule, and you know, we were kind of getting a late start on it. We were aiming for about 80% of the production to be laid out as a CG scene, regardless of what the background was going to be, whether it was going to be a CG background or whether it was going to be a hand-drawn 2D background. And so it was kind of interesting. So we kept that cinematic feel by just doing this kind of pre-vis in CG, and then taking the end result of that. Once we had nailed down a cut of the movie that everyone bought off on, then we said, okay, which one of these shots, you know, could be reduced to a hand-drawn background, and which one of these are we going to need a modeled CG background for?
And it wasn't just CG backgrounds though, because in that train sequence with the bursting into flames and stuff, that was incredibly complex, multi-plane. It seemed to have CG sort of elements, and it was ahead of its time.
The trains were, you know, trains and you know, that type of thing were CG as well.
But you know the scene I'm talking about, when they're trying to pull the train up the hill and then it crashes and falls back. So that was really elaborate scene.
Yeah, but like I said, that's why I said it's a mix of 2D hand-drawn backgrounds and then CG backgrounds, which had projected artwork on them.
Oh right, okay.
So it wasn't the kind of rendered illuminated, you know, CG illuminated scenes. It was essentially all the lighting was in the painting,
right?
And then the paintings were projected onto the backgrounds. But you know, it was a really interesting process, because you know it gave a really cinematic look to the you know, the film, even though it's like extremely painterly.
Well, I'm going to skip a couple of films, if that's all right, just for
sure,
time, and jump to Chicken Little, because I think, and certainly in my reading of sort of the modern 3D history of stuff, Chicken Little seemed to be a fairly pivotal film. You were on it as a layout artist. Now, the next film we'd go on to would be Meet the Robinsons as a stereoscopic layout artist. So I'm assuming that at Chicken Little time is where we pick up your stereoscopic interest. Is that right?
That's correct. I wasn't, you know, like I said, I was working on the just on the traditional or the 2D cinematography of the film as a layout artist. But at the time, I was first of all, that kind of put 3D on my radar. You know, that's when I started to realize, you know, the potential of it, and as well, that's when the, you know, the company's interest in it began to grow. And at the time they were starting up a Disney was starting up a new studio, Circle 7 Studios, which was going to be producing. This was prior to the Pixar merger. And it was going to be producing sequels to some of the Pixar films, and after the successful kind of 3D work on Chicken Little, the studio wanted to increase their commitment to 3D, and you know, basically they'd given the mandate that all of the films coming out of the Circle 7 studios were going to be 3D. And so, as the layout supervisor for that studio, you know, I began to do a little bit of research, and you know, because I was kind of excited about it, I had already been, you know, for, you know, several years been doing traditional CG layout, I guess, and I was, you know, kind of intrigued by the, you know, new challenges of doing something that was that was going to be stereoscopic. But I wanted to use it only in such a way that it was really going to, support the narrative of the story and, enhance the movie in general. I didn't want to do anything, you know, the traditional, 50s style, you know, gimmick shots or, you know, I wanted something that would be, that would, you know, be kind of taking a step back and saying, you know, hey, you know, this is now, let's say this is now a mature art form. How are we going to, you know, use, as artists, how are we going to use this in such a way that helps us better tell a story? And
so just give us the year. We're at about, what, 2006, 2007, is it the time frame? Or?
This was just prior to Meet the Robinsons. What would that have been, around
2006, I think.
Around 2005, 2006.
Yeah.
So anyway, and so you know, I was doing research and getting ready to, you know, to start making 3D films, you know, over there, and then the Pixar merger happened, and so at that point, you know, Pixar was going to be taking up the mantle of doing the, you know, the doing sequels such as the, you know, Toy Story 3, and anyway, so that left me you know, without a production to supervise, and so they asked me if I wanted to work on the. On the stereoscopic version of Meet the Robinsons.
But what I'd really like to ask you about, not to take anything away from the Robinsons,
sure.
Because it was, but I went to SIDGRAPH in San Diego, so we're now, I think it's like 2008, and
right.
There was a big function there, and there was a sort of a stereo thing, and it was one of the first times that there was a big stereo presence, I think, at SIDGRAPH in that way. And in the middle of a big Autodesk presentation with a bunch of other stuff that was being shown, suddenly a short film was shown. Now, this was a really interesting thing for us because this was post-Disney Pixar merger.
Right.
And there was a sense of what is going to happen with Disney and Pixar and what's going to happen. And I was stunned by this short. Can you tell us what that was?
Oh, you're talking about Glago's Guest.
Yeah. You were the supervisor on that, right? The stereo supervisor?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. I was. That's what I was working on while I was waiting for things to gear up for Bolt. You know, we were trying to, you know, explore some different types of pipelines. That was actually, there was a different type of production pipeline that we had been working on over at Circle 7 Studios. It was kind of different than Chicken Little had been done. And anyway, so this was kind of a test bed to see how that could be, you know, integrated into the, you know, into the filmmaking process, you know, here at Disney Animation Studios. And anyway, so Glago's Guest was the was essentially the first, I think, you know, the first thing that we did here that was really CG from the beginning, because as soon as it was laid out, which means that well, just to, our layout process begins with a CG animatic that's done. The CG animatic, you know, at that point they try to shoot coverage, and they kind of cycle back and forth with editorial to try to nail down a cut of the movie. And once that's done, then they break that out into the individual shots. They say, you know, okay, yeah, we use this camera from this frame range, this camera for that frame range, and you know, so at that point they have final cameras that they can export. As soon as they broke those out, we had already come up with a depth script based upon the beats of the film. You know, what are the, you know, big emotional moments? What are the lulls? And you know, when we can relax a bit. And you know, so based upon that script, you know, we went in and set up stereo rigs for each of the. For each of the shots. And so this was our first concurrent 2D, 3D production, really, and, you know, prior to Bolt.
Right. It was very successful. I mean, were you pleased with it? Because I thought on the night, we saw a lot of stereo stuff.
So.
It was one of the most stereoscopically interesting pieces. And that's kind of where my radar went off, because I wasn't expecting that from Disney. And it was different stylistically, but also it just felt much more polished in terms of its stereography than some of the other stuff, which around that time pre-Bolt and stuff was a little gimmicky, I mean, I must admit,
right.
In some of the studios. So you did, of course, then go on to do Bolt and Tangled.
Right.
And rather than go through those individually on any kind of shot-by-shot basis, I wondered if I could talk about some of the concepts that I've heard you talk about in the past, that
sure.
Maybe you could use examples from those two films to illustrate. And I think the place to start is the concept that you expounded about a stereo budget and how you really have a... And I'm not talking now over the film's budget, but maybe you
right.
could explain the concept.
Yeah, I mean, you know, essentially one of the biggest factors that you're dealing with, you know, because our philosophy is, you know, two-pronged. It's maximize comfort and maximize immersion. And those two things are often at odds with each other. But, you know, if you, when you analyze the factors that are, you know, that that lead to a comfortable viewing experience. There's some that aren't a factor at all in CG, you know, for the most part, because we don't have, you know, we don't have any of the registration and, you know, alignment problems that that happen in live action, you know, because we have theoretically perfect camera rigs. So, you know, a lot of that part has been taken out of the equation. Then there's still some stuff, even though, you know, we render left eye and right eye, there's still, because we have a highly composited method of rendering our final images, there are still things, compositing, 2D compositing tricks that can lead to artifacts and create some, you know, retinal rivalry. But largely speaking, the biggest thing that you can control is what your overall depth is. You know, and there's two, obviously, you know, two points where it becomes a factor. The far, extreme far depth where you hit against, you know, limits of fusion and, you hit into divergent parallax. And then there's the comfort factors of the near limits, things coming out of the screen. And chiefly, those are less significant on the big screen because, you know, those comfort factors are due to the two sets of muscles that we have working in our eyes, the ones that are responsible for the vergence or convergence of the image, and the ones that are responsible for accommodation or focus. Usually those are kind of reflexively linked, and they're used to working, you know, in sync with each other. Once you create a stereoscopic image that's projected on a screen that's at a fixed distance from the viewer, and yet you're calling upon them to converge at points that are, you know, lying outside of the screen, that difference you get between the convergence distance and the focal distance is, you know, something that, like I said, doesn't come naturally to our eyes and can be a comfort factor. Really the strong focal cues that our eyes have only go out about 15 feet from us. So, you know, given that you know, the screen, you know, typically you're sitting 40, 50 feet from a theater screen, it isn't that significant. And then, you know, 15 feet is kind of a maximum distance. As our eyes age, it gets more like, if you're over 40, it's more like 5 feet out.
that would be me.
Yeah, when you know, the focal cues start to weaken. So it's more of a factor, I guess, when you're sitting closer to a smaller screen.
And, yeah, absolutely. But let's discuss the far end of that, because
right.
we'll work our way back. Because the far end, we obviously never really need our eyes to look one to the right and one to the left. At best, we want to basically be looking in parallel when I'm looking at a mountain,
right,
you know, miles away.
Precisely. When we're looking at infinity, our lines of sight are parallel. And we never have to really, you know, go past that point. However, in stereoscopy, we have the ability to do that. And we can do it to a certain extent within acceptable bounds of comfort. You know, when you're looking at the geometry of a theater and a viewer sitting at a, you know, average distance, going to, let's say, two eye distances really means, maybe 1 degree of divergence or something. So we're talking about very small angles. And so it kind of becomes not too significant until you reach what I would call kind of a far maximum. And so the important thing was to, like I said, the paramount thing was to define what is our far maximum going to be, and to also use that in accordance with our depth script. So in other words, we would try to in a sequence that isn't as high a level of conflict, isn't as high a level of emotional content, we would try not to go to that, to stay at maximum one eye width apart. You know, in other words, stay at our normal sense of infinity. But go to kind of that perhaps two eye widths for a bigger sequence where we're trying to really push the limits. And what that translates into is the fact, well, you have to also consider there's a temporal aspect to it, which is also helped by the fact that we're following that depth script. So, you know, if you could, basically, if you watch the entire film, and the entire film never exceeded an eye width of separation on the screen, there would be nothing to really detract from the comfort in terms of far parallax or divergence. It wouldn't happen. If you're causing somebody to minimally diverge, but for a shorter period of time, it also doesn't really become much of a factor. So it's watching how far we diverge and for how long.
Right.
And so you know, by defining that and then defining, okay, what's the maximum amount that we want to come out of the screen during a typical part of the film. You know, there's you know, going to be out of the screen, you know, kind of reach moments, like something flying out of the screen,
yeah,
which is, you know, happening for like, you know, 5 frames and 3 frames and it's gone. That too isn't a factor. But something actually sitting out there for the entire shot, how far out are we, you know, are we comfortable with that? And that's kind of defining a near kind of normal distance as opposed to the outlying ones.
So let's set up some rules of thumb, avoiding the case that you would momentarily do something
right
beyond these, because obviously rules are bent a bit in
right
filmmaking. So obviously if we, and I think these are your numbers, 100 times the convergence, the parallax is kind of the separation. Like, so basically at some point, if we have something way beyond the convergence point, then we're really
right
trying to just be parallel, right? And that's kind of our back end limit.
Right. So, you know, obviously it's going to vary based upon screen size, but like a typical, let's say a 40-foot screen, you're dealing with an eye width separation would be something on the order of 20 pixels, let's say.
Right.
You know, in that ballpark. So if you're looking at a typical shot, 20 pixels, you're definitely not causing any divergence. Kind of the line in the sand that I'd like to draw is an absolute maximum of let's say 35 pixels. So that's kind of the point that I don't want to exceed for a maximum. So you know, this is all based obviously on 2K resolution and thinking about, you know, for digital cinema and thinking about that on a typical 40-foot screen.
Yeah, and the thing is that a lot of these things in stereo are very dependent on the space and the actual depth, because
right
in normal world, these things scale, right? Small screen scales
exactly
to big screen in mono. But the trouble is in stereo, your eyes don't scale, so your physical head enters into the equation, which means that everything actually has to be based in real numbers, not just kind
right
of rules of thumb.
Right. That's why we just have to have kind of a design criteria that we're basing it on, that we're aiming for. And like I said, when I'm thinking about it, I'm generally thinking about a viewer sitting one screen width away from a 40-foot screen.
Right. Now, at the other end of our sort of like sort of comfort zone, as it were, we can bring things out from the screen, and let's avoid breaking the edge of frame for an issue.
Right.
What's a good sort of rule of thumb about stuff coming in terms of out of the screen, the nearest pixel?
Well, okay, it goes back to an important thing that you know, consideration in terms of managing depth bandwidth. What I like to, and you know, what helps me balance that depth budget is the fact that there is a lot more usable space outside of the screen. Our eyes can, you know, converge forward, you know, into the negative parallax region. If you're looking at it in terms of pixel offsets, we can comfortably view something with a much larger positive parallax offset than we can a negative parallax offset.
Yeah, because I'm used to looking cross-eyed, but I never look divergent with my own head.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So that being the case, you know, and having that that, you know, depth budget I want to stay within. I don't want to go beyond that divergent parallax. What I try to do is shift the entire scene a little bit forward to use some of that out-of-the-screen space. And in order to do that without worrying about, you know, so-called window violations, getting those things that are being occluded by the edge of the screen but are stereoscopically in front of it, creating, you know, rivalry and otherwise flattening the image. To avoid that, we use this technique that we call floating window.
Okay, now I'm going to discuss floating window in 1 second. I'm going to push you because I remember you discussing the idea of convergence divided by two as your forward point.
So what I was going to say is, but using this technique, we shift the entire scene forward, and we have that extra real estate out front.
Yep.
And what I was going to say is, what one of the determining factors for me in terms of how far I'm willing to bring that you know, the typical things out of the window is the limits of how far I think the floating window holds up.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yep.
So that's what it. So for me, I don't feel that. And like I said, that I've seen other, you know, films use larger floating windows, but to me, it seems to break down after about 50 pixels.
Right.
There's just it's just impossible to avoid, you know, the ghosting and the rivalry that you get as a result of, you know, of bringing the window out further than that.
Well, having just said I was going to talk to you not about the window, I think we should talk about the window. So let's explain what that concept is, because it's not only a very powerful concept that lets you buy into that real estate in front of the screen in a audience relaxed way, but it's actually a technique you used an enormous amount on, say, Tangled. I think you remember you saying to me that you used it like on 95% of the shots or something.
It's ubiquitous in it, yeah.
Yeah, this is really a core part of your pipeline. So to explain to everyone what the floating window is.
So, you know, going back to just to quickly defining a window violation is anything being occluded by the edge of frame, but that is in front of it, so stereoscopically. So that creates a depth paradox, because we have two depth cues, occlusion, which is actually the strongest depth cue, versus stereopsis, which is a strong depth cue, obviously, but not as strong. So we have these two things at odds with each other. We can't resolve it, and it tends to flatten our perception of the image. And also, as a consequence of creating that window violation, we've also created rivalry. Part of the image is being seen only in one eye, and that gives it that kind of unstable, shimmery kind of quality. And so
just to paint a verbal picture for somebody, obviously in filmmaking, we want to do a two-shot a lot.
Right.
A two-shot over the shoulder is a good example, I think, for this, because a two-shot over the shoulder, I'm probably violating the edge of the frame with the foreground character's back on the left, say, because they've got I only want them in sort of three-quarters or a bit of the, you know, over the shoulder. I don't want to see all of their head or all of their body. So they've been cut off at the shoulders, they've been cut off in maybe half their head, they've been cut off at the top of frame. So they're like horrendous for stereo.
Right.
But they're meant to be even more forward than where I'm probably got my attention, which is the character they're talking to, which would be obviously facing camera in a two-shot. And so what we're saying here is that character who's back of head and back of shoulders feels like it should be much closer towards the audience, also is being cut off by the screen that makes me think I must be on the other side of some kind of window or viewing kind of plane. And that's where we get this conflict.
Right. It's a paradox. It's two things that you know, in our natural environment would never be at odds with each other, and yet, you know, we've created through the, you know, stereoscopic illusion, we've created this paradox that our brains can't really resolve.
Now, unfortunately, we quite like two shots.
That's right. So what we do is we just say, okay, you know what, we're going to create a virtual frame line, a virtual edge to the screen that we can now manipulate and move out in front of this object, and therefore there's no longer a violation. Both things are in sync with each other. The person whose shoulder we're looking at, the shoulder is both in front of this, in front, you know, out, coming outside of the physical screen. So it's out, you know, it's coming forwards in terms of stereopsis, but it's also behind the frame line that we've now, through a stereoscopic offset, brought forward.
I like to say that a floating window is a bit like the stereo version of a letterbox. It's a letterbox gave us a more cinematic look on a picture by just simply blacking the top and bottom. Here you're giving us a more stereoscopically valid image by basically putting a black window around it, but that window floats out in front.
Yes, it's adding depth to a letterbox, essentially. It's a masking that we apply that we can then manipulate the depth of and put it where we, you know, where we desire it to be. So this serves to, at the very basic level, it's a damage control thing. It's fixing something that's broken. We have a paradox that we've created by trying to manipulate this image stereoscopically, and now we want to set that right. We want to put both depth cues in sync with each other by floating this window out. And so, at the very basic level, it allows us to bring stuff forward using that out of screen, you know, real estate, while not creating a window violation. So, but like I said, that's kind of the base coat, just using that as damage control. Beyond that, it allows us to control the perception of where our subject is relative to the frame line, which has a lot of significance. The way we judge how far something is from us is relative to, you know, our kind of ground truth that we have when we're sitting in that theater, which is where that screen is. Is something in front of the screen or behind the screen? That's kind of the most significant thing that we use in terms of judging distance. Does something feel far or do we feel closer to it? And so, you know, I like to kind of equate the emotional separation the audience feels to the stereoscopic separation. Mm-hmm. So if we place something closer to the audience, they're going to, I think, naturally feel more of a connection to it than if it feels more distant. And so we create that feeling of distance and separation by having that gap between the frame line, you know, the physical screen of the theater, and where our subject is. So now if we were really to do that, without using a floating window, it would give us very little latitude in managing that depth budget.
Yeah.
By then, you know, taking that out of the equation and saying, okay, this is a separate attribute that we can control, the actual perceived location of the screen. That then frees us up to put things where they need to be to fit within our depth budget, but still control, for narrative purposes, that feeling of separation that the audience feels to the subject.
Now, for those that haven't seen something like Tangle, I should say, from my personal experience, I knew that you had the floating window, and for the love of anything, I couldn't really feel it floating. It felt just really natural the whole time. But I was all nodding, and yeah, that makes perfect sense, and I'm on board with you on that. And then you started discussing the fact that you weren't floating the window that I couldn't perceive when I was watching Tangled. You weren't even floating that window parallel to the real screen. You were tilting it and
moving
one side forward and back. Now, that just blew my mind. Why do you do that, and why doesn't it bug me?
to go to why it doesn't bug you. It doesn't bug you for the same reason that, that it doesn't bother you that we change camera perspective from shot to shot. When you don't have something that's perceived as a jump cut, you know, if you have something that's a unique, where you're presenting a unique point of view, we just perceive it as that, and we take for granted whatever changes have been made from scene to scene. You know, it's the whole reason, just in general, why the montage of cinema works. So that's the crux of why it works. But there are things that we avoid that would otherwise, just like the montage breaks down when you resort to a jump cut, right?
Yep.
There are things that you might do that would call attention to the floating window across the cut. So, but
why do you? Okay, so let's say I accept that and feel that that's a valid cinematic kind of thing. Why do you creatively want to literally, for want of a better term, keystone the floating window? Why does that something that your toolbox needs to do?
Well, for one thing, it's let's take your over the shoulder shot as an example. So in this case, if we were to just float out the entire window symmetrically, it would fix okay, from a just from a damage control standpoint, it would fix the floating window, the window violation rather.
Yep.
Right, because it would place our frame in front of the character's shoulder. However, at the same time, it would be if you brought out the other, you know, bringing out the opposite end of the window symmetrically, you'd be creating a huge gap between the viewer and the subject who you're really looking at. And so it's that emotional distance that you're creating. All of a sudden, you feel very detached from, you know, the person who's the very subject of what you're looking at.
Yeah, so what you'd be able to do is keep me still emotionally connected to our heroine on camera right, but our
right.
villain on camera left would just no longer be a technical problem.
Exactly.
And I can move on.
So that's the reason for like a what I call a slanted floating window, where you're bringing out
yep.
one side further than the other. The other thing, we can tilt it, you know, have the top part and the bottom edge of frame at different depths. And the reason for doing that is it is similar. Usually, just as you said, like a typical thing for bringing out one side of a floating window would be an over-the-shoulder shot. A typical motivation for bringing out like the bottom, for example, of the frame would be for a low angle shot, a shot where there's a lot of ground plane in front of you and the subject. So similar motivation, you want to fix the window violation that the ground is creating, but you don't want to create that extra separation, that artificial sense of separation from the character who's near the top of the frame.
Right, so in a scene in Tangled, for example, when they're running down, breaking out of jail or whatever, and they're in the castle, and I
right.
have the ground heading away into the screen because I'm looking down the hall, I want to feel connected with the action because I obviously want to be worried about whether they're going to be able to escape or not, and they're obviously running, and their eye line, presumably in a normal framing, would be like up at the top third of screen. But, of course, that bottom plane is going to be running right into our window. And so you would actually tilt it, therefore, so that I don't get so distanced from the character, but I don't get upset by the floor of the jail hallway they're running on.
Yes, that's correct. That's exactly what we're doing. We're trying to you know, manage the depth, and at the same time make sure that we're not defeating the kind of narrative purpose of the shot.
Okay, well, one other huge aspect I want to throw into this mix right now, because let's say we've got that in our mind's eye, the hallway scene, and a character stops, and they're you know, obviously being chased by somebody. You have a concept that's obviously quite common in stereo, but you have even like guidelines for directors and sequence supervisors of roundness as a kind of a numerical absolute. Can you explain
Correct.
That and how you create roundness of a character in that, say,
Right.
hallway sequence?
Well, I mean, if you look at what makes a character seem round, you know, from a perceptual standpoint, it's the fact that looking at it, you know, in a binocular fashion, you're seeing more of one side of the character in one eye and more around the other side of the character in the other. So that's kind of the sense of roundness. It's seeing a bit of the kind of, if you're looking at a face, which is a typical thing, you know, your right eye is seeing more of the
character's,
you know,
left ear,
the screen right side of a character's face,
yep.
and your left eye is seeing more of that screen left character. And that sense of looking around the object is what creates that impression of roundness. And roundness, though, however, it's one thing you have to remember is the fact that it's very dependent upon your, you know, distance, the distance from the viewer. So typically, when we're looking around something, if we bring something close to us, our eyes are getting more of an angle on the object, and we're seeing more of the sides of it. As the object moves away from us and eventually goes to infinity, we're not seeing really, you know, anything more of one side of the object in one eye than the other, and so it tends to look flat. And so that's a natural thing. The further we, you know, we get away from something, we're looking at something in the distance, it tends to look flat. When it's close to us, it looks round.
Okay. Well, imagine we've got a hallway scene and we've got Flynn Rider closer to camera.
Right.
And he's you know, looking left, looking right, working out whether he's going to run left or run right. Behind him in the distance, I'm making this shot up, is Rapunzel further down our hallway that we were just describing. Right. How am I making Flynn look round? Am I changing right. what?
Well, it all goes to, like I said, so since you want to be able to see more of one side than the other, the way you create roundness is through interaxial distance, separation between the cameras. So, but here's the thing. There's a bunch of different factors. Basically, what's going to make something look round at the end of the day is going to be how much overall parallax is there from the back of that object, like the back edge of a character's head to, the front of their head. How much parallax have we created? How much of a pixel offset? And so, what we're able to do is we have it's a proprietary thing, so I can't go too much into the detail, but sure. Essentially what it's doing is it's looking at what amount of parallax we have in terms of pixels from the back of a character's head to the front of their head.
Right.
And based upon that, comparing that to an algorithmic number that we came up with that we come up with for the shot that tells us how many pixels of offset would make that character subjectively look round to us.
Okay, now I've walked you down this path in a very manipulative fashion because I've set up our scene now where we've got our round character at the front with Flynn. We've got Rapunzel way down the back of our long hallway sequence. You've got me a floating window so that my floor doesn't look weird. But going right back to what we started the stereo discussion with our stereo budget, I'm going to say that we're now running into stereo problems because what's going on with the great stuff we're getting out of Flynn in the foreground is causing me to have problems with my stereo budget with Mandy Moore's character of Rapunzel way at the back of the hallway. And
right.
Here you have even another clever camera that can solve problems for you, right?
Exactly. So, yes, so now we've increased the interaxial separation, the spacing between our cameras to get Flynn to look round, right? We have our numerical assessment that pops up and tells us, okay, Flynn is now 80% round, right? Which is looking great. So we've got it. We've come up with a quantification of that. We know we're in a good space with Flynn, but now by moving those cameras apart as far as we did, all of a sudden we've created, let's say, now a lot of this is dependent upon the geometry of the scene and
sure.
the geometry of the camera lens. So let's say we happen to have had a longish lens that we're using. Now all of a sudden, when we went to the necessary interaxial separation to get that roundness, we may have created 100 pixels of divergence at the back of that hallway.
Right, and of course, the audience may look down to Rapunzel, and this is going to not be what we were scouting about, which is we've gone past what you wanted. So
right.
Now, in a live action situation or just a simplistic situation, you've entered a catch-22, right? You want
right.
the roundness of the guy at the front. You've solved a bunch of problems, but you can't solve the problem of the fact that if you go fixing up the back, you'll undo the roundness at the front.
Exactly. You have to make a choice and probably a compromise. You have to say, okay, I want to make this too deep and the character looks round, or I want to make this at a comfortable depth, but the character looks flat. And so you'll either choose one or the other, or you might do something in between. You might compromise and say, oh, I'm going to make the character a little bit flat and the scene a little bit too uncomfortably deep. And really none of those is satisfying. But unfortunately, usually in a live action situation, that's the predicament you're in. However, since we have this virtual world that we're working in, and we have, fortunately, the way our pipeline works, our rendering pipeline, it's based upon a heavily composited paradigm that allows us to break the scene apart into different sections and essentially lens each of those separate or use a separate stereo rig for each one so that we can essentially dial in the amount of depth we want. So we'll use that kind of larger interaxial separation on Flynn, on our character, to make him look nice and round. And then we'll take the background, that hallway, and use a more narrow separation to keep it within comfortable bounds. And then in the final composite, those will get assembled back together.
So basically,
to create, kind of the best of both worlds.
Instead of getting caught in a catch-22, you basically say, I don't believe in the no-win scenario, and just,
that's right.
Just do both.
Yes. And, you know, fortunately, we're in this, you know, in CG, we're in the a place where that's feasible right now.
I just wanted to get a comment from you on this, because it seems to me, and look, this is clearly borne out at the box office, because Tangled's hugely successful and
yes.
universally praised for its stereo. But do you feel, because of the advantages of both history and technology, that animated films are literally sort of defining and exploring a lot of this stereo stuff before the live-action guys? Because I've literally been talking to live-action films that are just about to come out, and they're not doing floating window, and they're obviously not deliberately
right.
compositing, unless they have a shot that allows it for
right.
for this effect.
Well, you know, floating window is something they could do. I mean,
yeah.
that's something that could be potentially within their toolbox. However, it's even that we have in animation we have an advantage. You know, at least the way it's done here at Disney with our pipeline, we have the ability to set up the floating window within camera space, in other words, within the actual scene, so that we have a physical representation of where within the space of our scene that window is going to lie.
Because you know all depth.
Right. Whereas for a live action thing, it would be more of a post process where, you know, at some point during your, you know, digital intermediate, you'd look at, you would kind of eyeball how far, you know, something's coming out of the screen, and then you would try to, you know, increase the masking, you know, until it's in front of that. So it's more of a, you know, it's kind of more difficult. You're doing it after the fact and trying to make it fit to match, versus we have a concrete representation of where it's going to appear when the film is viewed.
Antagonistic or anything, but don't you feel, I mean, I certainly feel that 3D films in a healthy way are able to lead the charge a bit more on this technology. Apart from anything else, it's cost-effective to do it. It's easy for you to experiment with this because obviously it's hard to experiment on set without running up a big budget. So,
oh, definitely. I mean, we have, you know, it's like a sandbox. I mean, I'm able to, you know, go through a lot of different, you know, permutations to come up with the perfect stereo setting for a shot. So, you know, obviously, you know, CG is always more of a kind of sandbox environment in that respect than a hot set where you have, you know, the clock is ticking and people are on, you know, on the time clock.
Yeah.
So that's always going to be a factor, but just from a technological standpoint, there just aren't, you know, because of just the physical limitations, there isn't the variety of tools in the tool belt of a live action stereographer. You know, there's no way that they could construct these so-called the multi-rig shot that we just kind of outlined, using more than one camera rig to kind of dissect and reassemble a scene. There's really no way to do that on a live action shot unless it happens to be a, you know, green screen.
Yeah.
And you know, and even then, that would be, you know, green screen shot would probably be at most you'd be able to create maybe two levels of multi-rigging. There were shots in Tangled that used up to eight separate stereo rigs to essentially break down the shot into separate components and then reassemble them, you know, in the exact manner that we wanted it. So that'd be something that'd be, you know, virtually impossible to do in most live-action cases currently.
Well, Robert, I just want to thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. I mean, it has been fascinating talking to you, and I honestly believe
that
Disney is leading the way with so much of this stuff, and then 3D is even, again, you know, at the forefront. But the fact that you're so happy to share this with us, we really do appreciate it.
Oh, no, I'm glad to. Like I said, you know, really, you know, proud of what we've been able to achieve here. You know, I really feel that, you know, on Tangled, we really pushed the limits of what's been possible in 3D. And, you know, I'm glad to be able to share that.
It's and it really, I go back to that time at SIDGRAPH when I saw that short, and I was like, "Wow, you guys are doing some really insanely cool stuff." I just had that sense from when I saw that, how well that sat in terms of everything else we saw that day. Nothing else was stereoscopically that clean, and I thought that this is going to be really interesting. And I don't think it's over yet, so I look forward to your next film. So thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Been great talking to you.
Well, that'll do it for this FX podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, we'll see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.